Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming here from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. Now, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have this a very interesting guest. His name is Mr. Robert Bickell, Sr. And shortly after the September 11th terrorist attack in New York City, why Bob Bickell was asked to act as an investigator and legal analyst for the law firm of John Michael Johnston's of Oklahoma City to determine the potential investigative and legal aspects of the attack. Now, the focus was directed towards the sponsorship of the terrorist attacks in the buildings, a sequential timeline and operational analysis to determine who the players were and would ultimately be shown to be. And shortly after the investigation started, it was determined that there was the possibility to show that there was an operational overlap that would support a reinvestigation of the Oklahoma City terrorist attacks for which Terry Nichols and Tim McVeigh had been convicted, supposedly putting the question of Islamic sponsorship of the Oklahoma City bombing attack to rest. The initial investigation subsequently resulted in the filing of a case against the Republic of Iraq by a group of victims and the survivors of the Oklahoma City bombing. And, of course, that is what we're going to be talking about tonight, is the involvement of Iraq in the Oklahoma City bombing. Now, if they were in any way involved, why isn't the administration using that as a justification for going to war with Iraq? If Iraq and Iraqi agents were involved in the attack on Oklahoma City, why is that being kept secret today? Well, there are a lot of things the government doesn't want you to know. And fortunately, Mr. Bickell has been studying this for a long time. And as the story unfolds tonight and develops tonight, you will begin to understand why the people at the highest echelons of our government don't want you to hear this story. Bob, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, why don't you just sort of give us just a little little of your background. Now, you've done a lot of investigations. In fact, you've actually worked with congressional organizations and for congressional hearings related to the chemical, biological, and nuclear weapon buildup of Iraq. What's that all about?
Well, being in the latter part of the 1980s, there were a number of things taking place that were pretty much out of the sight and out of the realm of reality for the general public. Nobody really knew about it, and the entire United States government, officialdom, pretty much wanted to keep it that way.
In other words, there were a lot of things they wanted to keep secret from the American people, is what you're saying.
Well, you know, there's reasonable secrets, and then there's reasonable secrets. In this particular instance, as it turned out for me and for a number of other people, the secretiveness of the entire issue with regard to Iraq and the involvement with the United States government, Germany, France, England, you know, probably half a dozen other countries, including some South American countries, in helping Iraq develop their war machine and their weapons facilities, were something that nobody really wanted out on the table for the entire general public to be able to look at and scrutinize, you know, to any great degree.
Well, now, of course, was our government, or at least people in the United States, at least in part responsible for Saddam's chemical and biological warfare capacity?
Well, it started as part of a secret policy initiative out of the Reagan White House. And that was pretty much for the purposes, of course, there's the Iran-Contra issue that was there and very dominant when Reagan took over the White House from Jimmy Carter. And then there was the problem with the series of attacks and aggressions between Iraq and Iran. And of course, the general feeling in Washington was that if you got to have a guerrilla, build your own guerrilla. And that's what they were doing with Iraq for a number of years prior to the invasion of Kuwait.
In other words, what we were doing was building up Saddam Hussein, and did we actually help to provide him with the wherewithal to build chemical and biological weapons?
Well, let me put it this way. When a number of the bombing drops were made in Iraq, those drops were made off of information that had already been in the hands of the United States military and the United States intelligence community, and then in some instances reinforced through the enforcement communities and investigations that were conducted there for some number of years prior to the Gulf War. That's because in a number of instances there were full sets of the blueprints of those particular chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons facilities in the hands of the United States military and the intelligence community here in the United States.
Well, but did they just have these things from intelligence, or had we actually in any way participated in their construction or in helping Saddam Hussein?
Well, we had participated in the construction of these particular facilities. We had had firsthand knowledge of a number of the supply conduits that were providing the weapons technology, the material technologies, you know, all of those kind of things that helped build up all of this. Plus, we already knew there was an investigation that I became involved in late 89 and early 90, where a friend of mine in Houston called me up and asked me if I would come to his office and discuss a client that he was thinking about taking on, who had come to him with a significant list of technology that they were wanting to acquire. He and I had a lunch and a meeting. I sat down and looked at that list of technology. It was five legal-sized pages. Those five legal-sized pages contained, you know, oscilloscopes for high-energy labs where they would be creating models for nuclear explosions or, you know, nuclear reactions. It also contained various kinds of radio antennas and you know, there's some somewhat mundane equipment. But the real piece of work on the whole list was a phased ray antenna system. And the only place you could get that antenna was if you could buy it disconnected from a Patriot missile battery. And as it turned out, these individuals who I met with later that same day with this friend of mine, they laid out on the table that they worked for the Iraqi government, that they were operating through a conduit here in the United States for the purposes of acquiring all of these materials for projects that were very close to the heart of the president of their country. And, of course, that initiated, you know, some antenna popping up on my part. Shortly after I walked out of that meeting, I called a contact of mine with the United States Customs Service that I'd known for a number of years. And an investigation was initiated that ultimately didn't last very long. It didn't last very long because there was already a complicity within the United States government, especially through the Commerce Department. Now, there were certain parts of the United States government that weren't real happy about Iraq being allowed to have all of these materials. There was some real opposition to it in the Pentagon.
Yeah, but I mean, there were other people who saw nothing wrong with it. Is that, would that be true?
Well, what they were looking at, and I mean, you had any number of different people that saw this as just a windfall. Everybody, you know, somebody was going to sell this material to Iraq. And, of course, our government had originally looked at it in terms of providing Iraq with the more mundane weaponry that would allow them to fight a war of attrition against Iran and keep Iran at bay in the Middle East. But somewhere along the line, of course, the wherewithal that Saddam Hussein was working under was that he intended to create a significant biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons system, and to be able to self-sustain the building and development of those systems in his own country. So he had to acquire a lot of technology. And ultimately, some of the work that I was involved in doing and analysis that I was involved in writing, I found out later somebody else had already been doing the same thing, but they were doing it for the purposes of providing these materials to Iraq, not keeping technology transfer of dual-use technologies out of the international market.
Well, now, of course, were these people or whoever was doing this, were they people associated with any branch of our government?
Well, they were with the Commerce Department.
All right. So they were within our Commerce Department. They were within our government. They were quite willing to let Saddam have these things, even though that they would have the capacity to be utilized in warfare, and even though their use was outlawed by international law.
Right. In some instances, as a matter of fact, there were a number of the things that were being transferred technology-wise from companies here in the United States that were specifically banned by multilateral treaties to which the United States were, you know, was a party.
Like chemical and biological weapons.
Chemical and biological and missile technology.
All right, fine. Well, now, of course, then you had an opportunity to investigate that, and you are certainly, as a trained investigator, then were asked to begin looking into the background of the possible relationship between the Iraqis and the attack on the World Trade Center, and that then took you back to an analysis of what was really behind the Oklahoma City bombing. And, of course, what they want us to believe is it was simply Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols' case closed. But there was a lot more to that. And, of course, a lot of this then ties over into the Philippines and the fact that Terry Nichols had started making trips to the Philippines as early as 1991 and 1992. And there he was meeting with agents of Osama bin Laden, people who worked with Osama and were part of this whole international al-Qaeda terrorist movement. And even more than that, it gets into something called Operation Bajinka. So why don't you begin to pick up the story? And for our listeners out there, why is Operation Bajinka important? Well, Operation Bajinka was something that was uncovered by the Philippine police in 1995, and it involved, at least in part, the hijacking of American planes and crashing them into the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, either the White House or the Capitol building, the Sears Tower in Chicago, and, of course, the Transamerica building in San Francisco. But we cannot let the American people know that, because if they knew that we knew ahead of time that there was a plan to hijack planes and crash them into the World Trade Center, how do we justify when we were on maximum alert in the weeks leading up to September 11th? Not having any planes in the air, certainly not doing anything to protect the World Trade Center, and certainly after the first North Tower was attacked, not to immediately evacuate the South Tower, instead of telling the people there to continue working, everything was safe. So why don't you pick up the story there, Bob?
Well, the interesting thing about the whole situation is that I had known Mike Johnson for quite some period of time.
He's
an attorney out of Oklahoma City. Mike had been involved in civil action that was filed in federal district courts in several different districts where he and a number of other attorneys represented people here in the United States who had been, they'd been burned. They'd had some of the technology that their companies owned and that they had developed over some long period of time literally stolen by the Iraqis and transferred into, you know, the Iraqi weapons technology facilities. And I had become acquainted with Mike, you know, back during that time. And at that, we're talking about, somewhere, I think the first time he and I talked was in June of 1989 or 1990. And we had worked together very closely and had, you know, shared information and documentation and what have you. As a matter of fact, if I've got any credibility at all, I think one of the best things that would speak for that is the fact that Ihsan Barbudi, who was a Prime primary Iraqi agent and conduit here, not only in the United States, but throughout Europe and South America, when Mike and some of the other attorneys were filing cases against Barbuti for fraudulently stealing technology from some of these other people that they represented, the Barbutis ultimately filed a motion in federal court in Oklahoma City requesting that any documentation or information that I had acquired or had investigated and ascertained the validity of be denied access for the purposes of that trial. So I figure, you know, if somebody's going to acknowledge you, the best way that that can be done as far as your validity is if they try to keep you out of the courtroom with what you've been able to investigate. But at that time, there were a number of other things and names that kept coming up. And one of the things that we found, and there are actually 7 separate instances that we can document direct ties between Ramzi Yosef, who is seen not only as one of the masterminds, not the mastermind, but one of the masterminds of the World Trade Center attack in 1993, also the Project Bojinka situation in 1995 there in the Philippines, but a number of other terrorist activities. He was involved with Iraq, and as I say, we can document that in seven separate points that we can identify Ramzi Yosef operating as an agent of the Iraqi military or Iraqi intelligence, the Mukhabarat. And one of the primary of those was the fact that Ramzi Yosef was in the offices of Ihsan Barbuti, IBI, Ihsan Barbuti International, his engineering offices, in London, England. He was there numerous times between 1986 and 1989.
All right, and of course, Barbuti was an Iraqi agent, and he was the one who was trying to get all of this equipment and technology to send to Saddam.
Right, widely publicized, or has been. Of course, when I say widely publicized, some of that means, to me, widely publicized among probably a very small number of people because everybody hadn't got the time to read some of the things that the rest of us do. But he was widely recognized by the United States intelligence community, the United States enforcement community. He was the subject of numerous investigations being conducted not only by the FBI, but the United States Customs Service. He was real high on the list of people that various congressional investigative groups were interested in, and the GAO, as a matter of fact. Because of some of the fraud that he had perpetrated with regard to accessing money through government loans, through the Agricultural Department. But
you mean he was getting money from our government?
Right.
Why would our government give an Iraqi agent, an agent for Saddam Hussein, large sums of money?
Well, they gave $5.3 billion. The United States Agricultural Department funded agricultural loans to Iraq to the tune of $5.3 billion.
Now, why would we do something like that unless maybe Saddam Hussein really wasn't as much as an enemy as the American people have been led to believe?
Well, you know, it would be hard to convince me that he wasn't the enemy that he has turned out to be. He's an absolute megalomaniac. He had at that time already been gassing his own people.
Some of the gas that we had helped him build, isn't it?
Right. We had provided on numerous instances out of some of the type culture organizations over here that provide biological strains, to various research groups around the world.
You're talking about bacteria, viruses, things like that.
Right.
Right.
Those things had been provided in mass.
So we had provided Saddam with the biological agents and the wherewithal to build the chemical weapons that he's now using to kill his own people and the Iranians. So
he threatened us with it.
Right. Well,
and
now
he
threatens
us. The funny part of it is, as you say, not really funny. It's funny ironic, not funny ha-ha, that he used our own money to buy it.
And of course, but it was not only the $5 billion from agriculture. He got another $5 billion from some bank down in the south. Some branch manager down there of an Italian bank.
Yeah, that's Banco Nacional de Lavoro. But
right.
You got Banco Nacional de Lavoro, Bank of Credit and Commerce International, and then also the agricultural loan program.
So he was getting money from all sorts of people.
He was great.
But of course, the interesting thing about that loan is the judge who tried the bank manager never believed that he hadn't been given orders from somebody very, very important to do that. Because, the judge who tried the bank manager said, I can't believe you gave a $5 billion loan on your own. Who told you to do it?
He gave those loans actually in $100 million, $200 million,
right.
$500 million increments.
Right.
But ultimately, and actually he was only to get his foot in the door with Iraq. Because Iraq were pretty tough cookies. Their negotiators were pretty tough cookies to deal with. And they were playing all ends against the middle. I mean, the Russians, the French, the U.S., everybody on the block. And these guys would come over here, and when they finally came back over here after they were taken off the terrorist list in late 89, early 90, they set up shop, reestablishing an embassy, or actually it wasn't 89 or 90, it was much earlier than that, it was back in the mid-80s. They set up shop, put their best foot forward. There were several organizations started here in the United States by people who had been senior members of government previously, not as registered agents for Iraq, but kind of off the books agents for Iraq. So, it was really kind of an interesting thing to look back at it and to watch the psychology at work of how everybody thought they were using each other. The United States thought they were using Iraq to keep Iran in check. Iraq was thoroughly convinced that they were using the United States and everybody else to get what they wanted. And the people that really wound up hurting in the process ultimately became Gulf War veterans, not only ours, but a number of other countries that were part of the alliance that have suffered from, Gulf War syndrome.
Well, now let's of course get on into where this is going to go as far as Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols are concerned.
Where it goes with Timothy McVeigh, the short trip, you have to get Iraq into the Oklahoma City bombing, to get Iraq into the support of terrorist activities against the United States. You have to understand that a major portion of it has been done where you have to draw a timeline. At the beginning of the timeline, on the left-hand side of the wall, would be two blocks. The first block would be Iraq, Ihsan Barbudi, and Ramzi Yousef, who acted as an agent for Iraq for a number of years. Then you have, in the second block, you have Osama bin Laden, Ramzi Yousef's uncle, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and Wali Khan Amin Shah, who was one of bin Laden's lieutenants and one of his favorite people in Afghanistan during the war in Afghanistan between the Afghanis and the Russians. Wali Khan ultimately was put in contact with Ramzi Yousef in the Philippines, possibly before.
All right, so for our listeners, Ramzi Yousef, kid came to America, and he was primarily responsible for building the bomb, at least the technology that was used to blow up the World Trade Center in February of 1993. And then he escapes, and he ends up in the Philippines about 1994, and here he comes in contact with this fellow Wali Khan, and he's also planning to blow up airplanes, American airplanes. He's planning on killing the Pope, and of course killing President Clinton. He's a very aggressive terrorist. He is one of the very, very clever. He knows how to build bombs and make them go off. In fact, he even did build one bomb and blew up some poor fellow sitting in a seat in an airplane and made a hole in the airplane. Fortunately, the plane survived. But so anyway, here's Ramzi Yosef, and he's over there in the Philippines, and he's working with Ali Khan and the others.
Right.
Wali Khan. Right.
What actually transpired, and you have to back up a little bit from what we know as Project Bojanka, what is presented publicly as Project Bojanka, is the plot as it was described and as it was described as having been foiled when Abdul Hakim Murad, another one of Ramzi Yosef's partners, made the mistake of washing his hands in the wrong sink after he'd been mixing chemicals there at the apartment on Donna Josefa Boulevard, or the Donna Josefa Apartments there in Manila, January the 8th of 1995. That's when Project Bojanka literally fell apart. Prior to that, you have to go back to the first meeting that Wali Khan, Amin Shah, Ramzi Yosef, Hakim Murad, Terry Nichols, another American by the name of, or the, whose name was given as John Lepney, and a fellow by the name of Edwin Angeles, had a meeting on the island of Mindanao, and this was the 17th of December, 1991.
All right, so here's Terry Nichols over at the Philippines in 1991. This is what the government couldn't let come out at the trial, either the Timothy McVeigh or the Terry Nichols trial, that Terry Nichols was tied into these Islamic terrorists going back to 1991, and the government did everything. In fact, the judge refused to allow any of this to be brought out at the trial, because you couldn't let the American people know in 1995 that the Islamic terrorists were tied into the death of 168 Americans, at least not at that time. So pick up the story from there.
Well, the interesting thing is that in that particular meeting, and I'll just read you one sentence out of the notes. This is a transcript of the handwritten notes of a Philippine intelligence deep cover agent that was actually second in charge of the Abu Saif during that period of time.
All right, that was Mr. Angeles.
That was Edwin Angeles.
And what you have to understand is that the Philippine government's secret agent was the co-founder of Abu Saif, the terrible terrorist organization that killed the American missionary recently. I remember the Burnham, Greg Burnham. And
right.
So here the Abu Saif, created by the Philippine government, kidnaps the American missionaries and kills them. But we can't let the American people know that this was co-founded by a Philippine intelligence government agent. Go ahead.
Well, it's a great deal more complex than that. Edwin Angeles was recruited by the Filipino National Police and the Filipino military intelligence organizations in 1998. He was trained, and then he was put in place as a deep cover agent, first with the Alex Bancayo Brigade, which is not really discussed that much in the wider media. But they're actually the gunslingers for the New People's Army, which is an offshoot of the Communist Party of the Philippines.
Okay, so we find the Islamic terrorists tying into the communists as well.
Right, and they scratch you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours among all the insurgency groups over there. It's such an incestuous kind of relationship among all of these groups, the Alex Bancayo Brigade, the New People's Army, Communist Party of the Philippines, the MILF, MNLF, and there's probably a half a dozen more, you know, including the Abu Saif, which has actually two different names. But what happened was that when the Abu Saif, when it became apparent through the intelligence sources over there that the Abu Saif was being created, there was a determination made and a decision made. And this decision was made not only by the Philippine military, and at that time the Philippine constabularies before the Filipino National Police was formed, and the American CIA.
Mm-hmm. Now the plot begins to thicken. So the CIA was in on the formation then of the Abu Saif?
Right. What they did was decide that they were going to penetrate the Abu Saif for the purposes of creating instability and being able to do wider intelligence operations against all the rest of these insurgency groups.
All right, we're going to have to take about a 3-minute break here, so if you'd like a cup of coffee or a drink of water, we'll be right back with Robert Bickle in just a moment here.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I'm going to have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there listening to us will want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we do what we do. And we've been getting a lot of emails from up in the Spokane area about not being on the air there. Now, we want our listeners to know that certainly our evening program, this program, we've had a very, very good response to. Our concern was, of course, the program we have on Saturday morning there at 10 o'clock in the Spokane area, which we just don't get that much of a response to. And so if you are up in the Spokane area, we hope that you'll tell others about that program. That is the Saturday morning program. That's the one we were thinking about discontinuing. And we're going to give it another month or so to see if we can build up at least some base of support for the Saturday morning program, because we, of course, enjoy doing it. Our evening program, we've had a very, very good response from the Spokane listeners, and we certainly appreciate that. But actually, of course, all of our programs, whether it's the evening program, afternoon program, morning program, are listener-supported. And if you're out there listening to us, why, we hope that many of you will seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and partnering with us on our effort to educate the American people about what's really going on in the world. And, of course, we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, historical, cultural, ideological battlefield, but it's still a spiritual battle. And, of course, behind all the schemes of men and demons is a higher hidden hand. And so if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. We hope many of you will want to go to our website. That's radioliberty.com, where you can pull down our programs. And we're actually on the Internet 5 hours a day. Many of those programs, all of our late Radio Liberty programs, are archived. Our monthly newsletter is available. If any of you out there would like to get a copy of our latest newsletter and you haven't had one before, we'd be glad to send it to you. Just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America truly is at war today. Again, our number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and, of course, our website, radioliberty.com. We're really dependent upon you telling others about our programs and telling others about our website, and then trying to convince them that there really is a problem. And I just want to mention for our listeners that we will be having an all-day seminar here in Santa Cruz on the 23rd of November. That's the weekend just before the Thanksgiving, and it's going to be at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. It's going to be starting at 8 o'clock in the morning. Actually, doors will open at 8 o'clock. The program will start at 8:45. It'll go to 5. There'll be a luncheon and a syllabus available. And if you'd like more information, give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And I realize many of the people from Spokane aren't going to be able to get there, but we hope many of our other listeners will. And, of course, everybody's welcome. If you want more information, again, the number 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening is Mr. Bob Bickle, and I'm going to ask not to take any calls right now, because I think that this story is so vitally important. So here we have Terry Nichols meeting with this terrorist group. What was that, December of 1991 or 92?
That was in 91.
1991.
Right. Let me just read you this, and of course, part of this is written kind of in failing or faltering English, let me put it that way. Later in 1991, December 17th, we were able to meet with Abdul Hakim Murad, Wali Khan, and a certain Abdul Basit, which I later came to know as Ahmed Yosef, through a certain Zachariah in Davos City. Terry Nichols was introduced together with John Lepney. We talked about an organizational alliance by helping the Arabs to procure firearms from Cebu and Manila and explosives chemicals. In doing the research, I started building a timeline. And with that timeline, I stretched it out across the wall and put on it what I consider to be all the major terrorist activities of the last 12 years. And I started with the Gulf War. Coming forward from that, you know, there are a number of different things. You have the World Trade Center in 93. You have the Blind Sheik and the landmark terrorist plots just shortly after that. And several others all the way through, including the Oklahoma City bombing, the dual embassy bombing in Africa, the Khobar Towers, and then, you know, all the way up to September the 11th. There were a total of like 15 or 16 different terrorist attacks on here. Based on this statement from Edwin Angeles, what you can literally do is put Terry Nichols in a four-column operational chart for numerous terrorist activities, starting, you know, from the Oklahoma City bombing backwards, and including the World Trade Center bombing.
All right, now where is Terry getting his money? I mean, certainly here's a man who, you know, always seems to have enough money to take repeated trips to the Philippines and go over there. Costs money to go, costs money to stay there. No, he's not working on a regular basis. Where is Terry Nichols getting his funding?
Well, Terry Nichols had some money to begin with. I had questioned that originally, partially because of the sources that information came through. But then I found a reference to the fact that when he and his first wife separated and divorced, they had several pieces of property that they had gathered up over the 9 or 10 years that they were married. Terry got several of those properties, and she got the rest of them. You know, they split them up pretty evenly. Terry sold not only the 80-acre farm with a nice home on it that they had been living in up there in Michigan, but also two other pieces of property, and his net out of those pieces of property after they sold was something approaching $112,000 or $115,000. That's a pretty sizable chunk of change. Of course, from there forward, you know, when Terry Nichols joined the Army and met Tim McVeigh, that was pure happenstance. That was just about the biggest piece of serendipity that I've ever seen in my entire life. You know, nothing planned, nothing sinister. Terry Nichols is a complete screw-up. He and his wife have been on the verge of divorce and separated on numerous occasions for probably 2 years before he joined the Army in 1988. But he didn't stay in the Army but about 11 months. And just shortly after he joined the Army, she filed for divorce from him. And so he was just still kind of flailing around and trying to figure out what he was going to do, and then ultimately decided he didn't want to be in the Army anymore, and he filed for a discharge, a hardship discharge, because he was going to be a single parent. Well, immediately after he gets his hardship discharge, he's just barely divorced from his first wife. He comes up with this brainstorm that he's going to go to the Philippines in search of a Filipino mail order bride, dumps the son, you know, their son, who he had used for the excuse for his hardship discharge, on his wife in Las Vegas, where she had moved and set herself up in a real estate business. And he takes off to the Philippines in August of 1990. Now, the interesting thing is that when he gets to the Philippines, he steps off the plane into the waiting arms of a group of people that, to call them trailer park trash would be a real high compliment for him. His second wife, Mare Fay. She and her sister and a number of these other little gals over there had pretty much signed up with and ran with a group that were well known as prostitutes. Matter of fact, at a number of the weddings of these different people over there, one of the primary attendees was a gal that was a madam. So, you know, it's a little bit different than what a lot of people think and what a lot of people have had presented to them through the media, by the government, you know, on whatever basis. Just not as clean and not as neat as everybody would have you think. But when he gets there, one of these gals that's a tour guide, he went over there, found his way there, and this is one of the questions that we all had been trying to figure out. Myself, a number of other people that have been involved in the investigation of Terry Nichols and Tim McVeigh. How did Terry Nichols get to the Philippines? What possessed Terry Nichols to go to the Philippines? And who was he running with when he got there? And that's been a significant question. Then another big question, after you get far enough into this and you start looking at the trial, why is the answer to those two questions so important to have the answers and the documentation for that answer denied entry into evidence in a trial?
Mm-hmm. In other words, who's covering it up and why?
Right.
And, of course, if any of our listeners have read the books by Stephen Jones, Timothy McVeigh's attorney, Others Unknown, and Others Unknown, the Oklahoma City bombing conspiracy, you find out that the judge who was in charge of the trial violated every tenet of legal precept and refused to allow Stephen Jones to bring this information into the trial because, of course, Stephen Jones was trying to show there was a much larger conspiracy. And, of course, the government did not want that. In fact, everything was ever done to cover up, you know, the fact that the government knew about the bombing of the Oklahoma City. Beforehand, they knew there was a plan to bomb the Oklahoma City building. They certainly had to cover up this aspect of it, and that was the Islamic connection. So they simply lied, and with the help of the judge, they were able to do that.
Well, that's the way it appears. Stephen Jones... I really enjoy Stephen Jones. I have a great deal of respect for Stephen Jones. In actuality, he's not trying to be patronizing or anything else, and really don't care what other people may say or think of Stephen Jones, you know, based on their own perceptions. Stephen Jones is probably one of my favorite people. He's a genuinely nice individual, and he's a great deal more sophisticated than what he presents himself as just a country lawyer or a county seat lawyer, as he likes to say. But Stephen Jones was denied the ability to really represent Tim McVeigh. Now, I have told Stephen Jones that I have had nothing that I have seen in any documentation that would indicate to me that his client deserved any clemency.
Oh, no, Timothy McVeigh was guilty of sin.
Stephen Jones recognizes that.
But he was part of something much bigger that the government doesn't want the public to know about.
Sure, and you know, the thing of it is that people have left Tim McVeigh sitting out there, and several of us have kind of adapted the deal where we refer to it as Lee Harvey McVeigh and his faithful sidekick, Terry Nichols. Terry Nichols is set pretty much back in the dark.
Whereas, of course, in all probability, Terry was much more significant in this than Timothy McVeigh.
Because Terry Nichols was significant in it all the way back to 1991,
right.
December
right.
of 91. And then as you move forward, Terry Nichols is the one that had the initial introduction to and the entree into the Islamic fundamentalist community in the Philippines.
And that's where John Doe 2, 3, and 4 came in.
No, they're from here.
Right, but what I mean is that somehow they were tied into this, weren't they?
Well, the John Doe 2, 3, and 4...
were Iraqis?
They're probably out of a different cast of characters that originates here in the United States that were already here as agents in place.
Okay.
You have two separate groups. Well, let me kind of lay it out a little bit differently. You have Terry Nichols operating with Ramsey Yosef and his associates in the Philippines. That is where you get the direct contact between Terry Nichols and the Islamic fundamentalists, who are supported and sponsored in many instances by the Iraqi state, Saddam Hussein, and through various conduits, including the Mukhabarat and other places.
But doesn't that also tie into Osama bin Laden?
And it also ties in directly to Osama bin Laden.
Okay. And doesn't it also tie into Iran? Is there an Iranian contact?
There's an Iranian contact in this. I haven't quite figured out where to put him yet, but the Iranians play a big part in this. And that goes back to another issue that really muddies the water and makes people's eyes glaze over when you start putting all of it on one wall, because there was more or less a terrorist co-op created back in the early 80s, late 70s and early 80s, with agreements that kind of ebbed and flowed, and some days they were on and some days they were off, but they had four major players. You had Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Libya. And they were all agreeing to agree that they would use the Islamic State, quote-unquote, as a means to an end to spread their particular brand of whatever they wanted to do throughout any number of places on the face of this earth. Essentially, where Islamic fundamentalism has replicated itself to the degree that it has surpassed the threat that communism was, or what we thought it was, 15, 20 years ago. Communism is nowhere near the threat today that it was before the wall fell in Berlin and before the Soviet Union started falling apart. Islamic fundamentalism today represents a larger threat. And the door to Baghdad opens and closes in the Philippines, as far as the Oklahoma City bombing, the World Trade Center bombing, September the 11th. Just pick one.
So
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, what you have is this series of attacks that have taken place over the last 12 years, almost 13 years. And in every instance, the thing that I was telling you about earlier, I built this timeline, and then during Osama bin Laden's trial here in the United States for the dual embassy bombing, he was tried in absentia along with a number of other people who were in the courtroom. But one of their operations people said that there was a four-part line of operations where you could lay it out in four columns on a piece of paper. The first column you could put in there would be the state sponsors and whoever their management team was, for lack of a better phrase. The second column would be intelligence and target surveillance and the people that participated in that. The third team would be logistics, which is the people that made travel arrangements, the people that bought the materials for the bombs, the people that bought the detonators, the people that transported the materials for the bombs. And then ultimately the fourth category, the fourth column, would be the actual perpetrators that delivered the bomb to the target. And in very, very few instances do I find, all the way across all of this series of terrorist attacks, that you have less than 15 to 18 people involved in conducting any of these bombings. They have got a very strict order of battle. In the Philippines, what you have is Ramsey Yosef, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Osama bin Laden's brother-in-law, Khalifa. You have Terry Nichols. You have a number of other people who are directly associated with, you know, either the planning or the development of the plan or the surveillance of targets all the way through from 1991 and 92 forward through 1995. In the investigation that I was conducting, I kept looking at this on a profiling basis, and I kept seeing in this deal, you've got a very singular mentality that is a guiding force all the way across the board.
So actually, Ramzi Yosef then leaves the Philippines and eventually ends up in New York City early in 1993 for the first bombing of the World Trade Center. Is that right?
Right.
And of course, he at least is instrumental in building the bomb. He escapes. They leave a lot of fall guys there. And of course, then he goes back over to the Philippines, and he starts planning again. Now, does he meet with Terry Nichols again after that?
Yes, they met with Nichols on several occasions. All Nichols, right. If you take what Edwin Angeles says verbatim, and I do because I've had the opportunity to go through not only that set of notes, and this is a transcription of a handwritten set of notes that were given by Edwin Angeles to investigators in the Philippines. I also have several other transcripts of interviews and interrogations of Edwin Angeles that were conducted over a period of time.
And didn't his wife actually make a deathbed statement?
Right, I made arrangements with a contact of mine in the Philippines for him to, initially she had sent word that she wanted to talk to somebody. And then we made arrangements to have him meet with her because we couldn't get there as fast as what she was going downhill from a health standpoint.
I would say she was dying of cancer, and this was the second wife of Edward Angeles, and
right.
That story was recently written up in Insight magazine.
That's correct, and what had happened was that I had made arrangements with the contact that we had over there for him to travel from Mindanao to the island of Basilan to visit with her and to conduct the interview that, you know, was ultimately written up, and actually the entire transcript of that interview that he conducted with her is actually at Insight Magazine's website.
Right.
But in that particular instance, you know, she verified a lot of things that Angeles had said, and as a deathbed statement, it is admissible in any court of law in the United States. So, you know, we feel like that information is extremely good. The other things about Edwin Angeles' interviews and interrogations, he has his detractors. He has people within the Philippine military intelligence and the Filipino National Police that would like to have everybody think that he was just a flake and he was more problems than he was worth and what have you, but he was the key for the Filipino National Police, the FAA in the United States, the Aviation Commission in the Philippines, and the Japanese to breaking the Project Bojinka down to where they understood exactly what had happened and how it had come together. He provided the information on all of that. He turned himself in February of 1995. Project Bojinka, the plot had fallen apart where the fire took place January the 8th of 1995. The downing of the PAL flight 434 had taken place on December the 11th of 1994, where Yosef had flown from Manila to Cebu, planted a bomb that he had secreted away, part of it in his shoes, part of it in his shaving kit. He had all of those things where he put them together and then put them in under the seat that he was, you know, where he was flying. When he got off the plane and the plane continued on to its next leg of flight to Narita, Japan, a Japanese engineer took that seat, and when the bomb went off, he was killed, and a large hole was blown in the side of the plane, but they were able to land the plane there in Japan. The investigation was immediately undertaken by a multinational investigative group, including members of the Joint Terrorism Task Force here in the United States, that had originally investigated the World Trade Center bombing. some of those people whose names I have here where you can track their involvement all the way through, you know, they were looking for Ramzi Yousef already. They go to Japan, they start doing that investigation, then they figure out that it is a bomb, and the bomb was originated in the Philippines, so then the focus became the Philippines and the international terrorist organizations operating there. They still didn't have a clue who the key element of things were until such time as Edwin Angeles gave himself up almost 30 days after the Project Bojinka plot went up in smoke in the Donna Josefa apartments. And at that point is where he came on board and started assisting in the investigation.
Well, we're just about out of time. Could you quickly tell our listeners what Operation Bojinka really was?
Well, Operation Bojinka, in actuality, was a series of terrorist activities that were going to be undertaken by the entire group of people there that were part of Ramzi Yousef's operating cell. Part of it was going to involve the assassination of Pope Paul II. Another element of it was the assassination of President Clinton. There was also an element of it that was revolved around the assassination of President Fidel Ramos of the Philippines. There was another element of it that involved the assassination of two more of his senior staff people. Then there was the planning and the initiation of the plot to bomb 12 U.S. commercial airliners. And then there was the planning and the initiation of a plot to hijack and crash U.S. commercial airliners into buildings here in the United States.
And what specific buildings did they specify, though?
Well, those specific buildings were going to be scattered all the way across the United States. And part of it was going to become, and I'm trying to get back to my notes here on that, those particular buildings. You have two. One of the things that you and I talked about the other day.
I'm afraid we're out of time. We're going to have to get you back here again. But wasn't one of the buildings the World Trade Center?
It was the Sears Tower, the Trans-American Tower, and the World Trade Center in New York.
That's what it was all about. Well, we're going to have
to. That's what it was about.
We'll get to Bob back here very, very soon. Thank you so much for being with us. We're just going to have to say goodbye to our listeners up there in the great state of Washington and Oregon and Western Idaho. Thanks so much, Bob. Talking to you off the air.
All right. Thank
Bye-bye.
You, sir.
So until tomorrow, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being because we have with us on the line Randy Thomason from the Campaign for California Families. Hi, Randy. How's everything going?
Hello, Dr. Stan. It's good to hear your voice again. Well, as they say, it goes.
Well, what's happening up there in Sacramento?
Well, the state capital of California is not very active except to say that there are people who have to work during the rest of the year to vote good or bad on laws who are now working in their offices either fretting or fuming or working on trying to get someone else elected, either themselves or someone they would like to have elected. We are about 3 weeks away from the election, and it's going to be sort of status quo for most of the seats in the state. The Republicans and Democrats struck a deal with the new census redrawn of the lines, and there's not going to be any competitive districts, so to speak, except in the Central Valley and a little bit on the Central Coast. So it's going to be interesting, especially your state Senate race, which pits Rusty Arias, Democrat, versus Jeff Denham, Republican, and that's stretching from Monterey County over into the Central Valley. That's the only real competitive state Senate race in the state. Denham has signed the marriage protection pledge. Rusty Arias has not. That's a key distinction there. You've got a very interesting race down in your area, Dr. Stan, right there on the Central Coast. The Santa Cruz area, the 27th Assembly District is open. It's pitting a Democrat, a homosexual man named John Laird, versus a Republican Christian named Chuck Carter. And that's going to be a real shootout. I've been seeing things in the email about that one. It's chances are it would go toward the homosexual Democrat, and if he got elected, that would mean two homosexual state assemblymen in California for the first time in history.
But, of course, we've got a couple of homosexual lesbians there, so what else is new?
It's just going to be more indecency. And when I talk about indecency, I especially think of the laws. We have a great victory, as you know. The transsexual foster care bill was defeated, and we were privileged to help lead the way on that. There was much work, but many people got involved and made phone calls and different organizations got involved. And God gave us a victory against a very nervous Governor Gray Davis here in this election year.
But, of course, once the election is over, why, Governor Davis will be secure for the next 4 years, and he'll sign it next year round. There's no question.
I would think so, if he's reelected. And, of course, the governor's race is the big one that either everybody is looking at or everybody's looking away from. but that still seems to be a tightening race between Gray Davis and Bill Simon. Of course, there was a debate a week ago in L.A., if you want to call it a debate. Both men came out sort of swinging at each other. I noticed that the homosexual agenda and abortion were really not part of the debate at all. There were questions that neither man answered. Over the last week, there has been the discussion in the public eye about did Gray Davis take a check? Did he do fundraising illegally from a government office? And there was a picture circulated of him with a $10,000 check. It seems clear that check was given legally and it was not in a government facility. Still, there's a whole pack of evidence that Gray Davis has been using his office to raise money ad nauseum, and that's turned a lot of people off. And so even though the photo was a fair photo, if you will, on Gray Davis's part, it showed him in a light that made a lot of people think, well, this is just stinky, because it sort of confirms their suspicions of a lot of other things he's done.
But, of course, the truth of the matter was what he did was perfectly illegal.
Yes,
so,
it was. That was in Santa Monica location. So the photo was taken of a perfectly legal transaction. However, what I'm saying is that it probably put a picture to what people knew. They've been hearing for over a year about Gray Davis getting checks and asking for money right around bill signings or when bills were introduced. And you've heard the term pay to play, and that is coming into a brand new prominence. And so, that's why a lot of Democrats are not going to vote for Gray Davis. It seems that he's turned a lot of people off just because they don't think that they can trust him. Of course, on the other side, Bill Simon has had plenty of troubles himself. It's sort of hard to find out where he stands on certain issues. There was a whole, while it was more than a flap, it was a definite confusion about where he stood on the homosexual agenda and protecting the rights of marriage. There's been pressure from people in the pro-family community. He appears to be backing away from that right now. But I know a lot of people who are unmotivated to vote, Dr. Stan. And so 3 weeks out, it's going to be a very low voter turnout, I think lower than ever. Of course, that means those who go to the poll, mathematically, their vote carries more weight. And so it's sort of like when the stocks are low, when you buy stocks, you can get them cheaper and it's a better deal. This is a time when your vote can matter the most when you get to the polls.
What a tragedy it is that here in a great state such as ours, the fifth or sixth largest economy in the entire world, we get a choice of two candidates like we have.
A lot of people are scratching their heads, and I have thought and prayed about this more than any other race in my life. It is not a good situation. I think we can see that with Bill Simon, it would be, if he were governor, it would be easier to lobby him to veto the bad bills than Gray Davis. Yet, I'm among those who wish that we had a lot more solid a choice in terms of knowing where Simon stood on some things. So I say, well, you know what? Let's go into this election. Let's make sure we're voting, register to vote. And I do want to give the public call to anyone who's not registered to vote. You've got a deadline of 6 days from now. The 21st is the deadline to register to vote. So please go to the fire station or the library. Get a voter registration card, fill it out, and mail it immediately. And this is the last weekend for churches to do voter registration drives. You can do that right in the church. You just contact your voter registration office in your local area, your county register of voters, and you say, I'd like to check out a lot of voter registration forms. You can get hundreds of them.
All right, why don't you give your telephone number and your website for us?
Sure, thank you, Dr. Stan. The website is savecalifornia.com. Visit savecalifornia.com, and you can sign up for free email updates. You can also check out the voting records of people at the state capitol. We've got new voting records posted, and you can see how Bruce McPherson, your state senator, has been voting for the last 3 years, for example. And I'll just leave it at that. We love for people to visit savecalifornia.com. And Dr. Stan, thanks for you. Keep up the good work.
You too. Bye-bye, Randy.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Now let's go to Brad Dacus here. Brad, are you there?
Yes, I am, Dr. Stan.
How's everything going for you? Brad Dacus is with the Pacific Justice Institute, and they're out there defending our rights there in the, as far in the legal field. Brad's a lawyer, and of course, his hope is to defend Christians who are coming under persecution and prosecution from one or another of these anti-Christian groups out there. So what's the latest problem?
Well, the latest involves a church located in the Santa Cruz area. And this is a church where, a Lutheran church where they have a part of their land for the homeless. And yet they've been told that these 15 families, that up to 15 families that are there, that ministry has to come to a halt. In fact, they've been red tagged by the county and told that they will be fined, a heavy fine, of unless they do not immediately stop this ministry. And yet there's no houses near there. It's on 5 acres of land. And the only one who complained, who even made the complaint, were people who were actually trespassing and hiking on the land.
So basically, what are you going to do?
Well, we have pledged to represent the church, and we have actually sent a demand letter to the county of Santa Cruz. You know, if Santa Cruz, you'd think would be happy and grateful that a church would be, solving a part of the problems of dealing with people who are really homeless.
And what do they do? Do they have houses, or do they have tents, or how are they putting these people up?
They have tents and trailers, and the people living there are, it's not like, you know, people who are bums and into drugs. No, it's people who are down and out. They have there's often have children, and these people want to stay there at the church because other places where homeless stay, often there is high crime and drugs and a lot of problems. These are people who are down and out that the church is trying to get back on their feet and back into society. And so, to them, this is their haven for getting their act back together again and finding a place that's stable for their family. So. That's sometimes that happens, and I would much rather see the church playing this role than to see the Santa Cruz County play the role. But nonetheless, Santa Cruz is trying to once again to punish this church, threatening to shut down their ministry and heavily fine this church in a very severe way. So we've made it very clear that this church is protected by the Religious Land Use Act to be able to engage in such ministries unless the county can come up with a real compelling reason not to.
All right. God bless you for everything you're doing. You want to get out your telephone number and your website?
Oh, you bet. Our telephone number is 888-305-9129. That's 888-305-9129. And if people like to be caught up with our active cases, our litigation that we're involved in, they can do so also by signing up on our webpage at pacificjustice.org. That's pacificjustice.org.
All right, thank you so much, Brad, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that was Brad Dacus, and now, of course, we're going to go to our guest for this rest of the evening, and that's going to be John Spring, and John is a geographer, and he, of course, has some very strong views on what's happening in the Middle East, and, of course, we'll be glad to take your calls here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you agree, you disagree, why? But the important thing to realize is that we are going into a war in the Middle East, and this war was planned long before the attack on the World Trade Center. In fact, had we not had the attack on the World Trade Center, how would they ever got the American people to be willing to go to war in the Middle East? And I would simply ask that question rhetorically, but the Sunday Herald Tribune has come out with information that there was a plan to go to war in the Middle East that was laid out by Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz back in the year 2000, before George Bush was ever elected to the presidency. I had heard this actually about a year and a half ago in an article in Newsmax magazine. So what you're having to understand is everything is carefully scripted. But how would you get the American people to be willing to go to war? Well, we had to have an incident, and we had an incident. The government was well aware of the fact there was going to be terrorist attacks on America. Congress had voted literally billions of additional dollars in funding for the Federal Bureau of Investigation to deal with terrorism. And what did the Federal Bureau of Investigation do? Why, they hired 1,000 new agents, something like that. But none of them were allowed to work on terrorism. In fact, any of the FBI agents who wanted to work on terrorism were undermined, and this is what happened to John O'Neill, who was director of the Counterterrorism Task Force in New York. He wasn't allowed to proceed with doing any investigation. The same thing happened, of course, with people. There was a fellow named Wright in Chicago, and he wanted to investigate terrorism, an FBI agent. He wasn't allowed to investigate it. The Williams down in Phoenix had written a memo talking about how that the Islamists were, these radical people were actually involved in the flight schools, and he wondered if they were being trained for some purposes. We know that one of the FBI officials up in Minneapolis, where they were involved with the investigation of Zacharias Massui, had said, well, you know, we are not going to do anything. Why, this man could actually fly a loaded plane into the World Trade Center. He made that statement. We know that there were a number of other FBI agents who were blocked from investigating Islamic terrorism, and yet, of course, the FBI knew that the attack was imminent. And the question is, why would you block agents from doing what was logical? We know that two of the terrorists who were on the planes were living in the home of an FBI informant in Southern California. There's so much additional information if we had time. All we can say is you should read the testimony of Christina Brutweiser on the 18th of September. We actually have that. It's up on the Internet. She lost her husband in the South Tower. And as she says, you know, it's the most amazing thing within just hours of the attack, why the FBI was going to the homes of all of these people to investigate them. They knew where they were. They knew where they'd been. They knew everything about them. Within hours of the attack, how could they possibly have had that all that information if they didn't know who they were ahead of time? And I think that's a very, very interesting observation. You really need to get her testimony. We have it available. Well, if you want to know more about that, you can go up on the web or give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. But you have to understand that the government knew a lot more than they're letting us know. But there had to be an incident. How else would you get the American people to be willing to go to war? Well, with us is John Spring. John, how are you this evening?
Real fine, Dr. Stan. It's a pleasure to be on your program again.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you share your concerns with our listeners?
Well, I thought I might begin with Bali, because this is an area of the world which very few Americans are well aware. And Bali is one of the smaller islands to the east of Java, and it has a predominantly Buddhist Hindu population, unlike the island of Java, which has close to 200 million Muslims. And it appears that a jihadist faction such as Al-Qaeda decided to attack the resort areas on that island recently. And one thing that was shared with me just this morning in one of my contacts with an individual who has quite a bit of expertise in that area is that he makes a distinction between what he refers to as Muslims and Mohammedism, or Mohammedists. And I think we could translate the word Mohammedist to be the same as what you and I would refer to as Wahhabis. And he makes this distinction because he does not want to imply that all Islamic people are terrorists or violent people. But unfortunately, we do have that faction which needs to be reckoned with. And why do I bring this up? Because we have to understand that of all the nations of the world, Indonesia is the most populated Islamic nation throughout all of the Muslim world. And in terms of percentages, the Middle East holds only about 20% of the entire population of Islam. And the rest is skewed more towards South and Southeast Asia and the Pacific areas. And We have to again focus on what is the main reason for us going into Iraq. Now, I was under the impression that we were fighting a war against terrorism. But the terrorism is sponsored mainly by the Wahhabists or the jihadists rather than by Saddam Hussein, who, by the way, has a secular nation. And I don't think that by going into Iraq that we're going to resolve the problem that we're having with terrorism throughout the entire globe. And I just hope that more people would focus on that concern at this time. Because,
maybe we're not really fighting terrorism. Maybe we're trying to make the American people feel we're fighting terrorism. But one only has to look at the fact that the government has refused to seal our borders. The government has continued to allow people from nations that are cited as terrorist nations by our State Department. 125,000 of them were allowed to come into America between October of last year and the present time. Certainly, the government is fighting terrorism by wanting to make all the people who are here illegal legal. The government is fighting terrorism by wanting to repeal the Posse Comitatus laws, to have every American carry an ID card, to pass the USA Patriot Act, which really does away with our constitutional protections of freedom.
Yes,
and there's nothing in that that mentions Islamic terrorism. In fact, they redefine terrorism in this act. So, maybe the battle really isn't against terrorism at all. Maybe the battle is against the American people and freedom.
Well, this is one thing that we have to be on guard against, because there's a very good possibility that that could occur, especially when we don't have a checks and balance system in place at this particular moment in time.
Well, we used to have a system of checks and balances, but the Office of Homeland Security is designed to do away with the system of checks and balances, and that's why at least some of the senators back there are objecting to it. And it is the most amazing thing, John, if you read the newspapers, they will try to convince you that, oh, well, the reason that they're fighting back there in the Senate is because it has to do with civil service for the people in the Office of Homeland Security. And although that is a minor issue, that is not the issue at all. If you read what Senator Byrd and the others are saying, they're talking about the Office of Homeland Security does away with the system of checks and balances and puts all power with the executive branch of government, which is what our forefathers feared. And that's why they set the system up the way that they did. And the fact that the media is so controlled in America that most people don't understand why some of the senators are objecting to the Office of Homeland Security. They don't really understand what this involves. It reflects the degree of control that exists over the media and ultimately over what the American people think and believe.
This is so true, Dr. Stan, and we need to awaken the American people before it is too late, because once our freedoms are lost, it's going to be very difficult, if ever, to acquire them back again. And this is basically the bottom line. You know, I was sort of reminiscing earlier this week about the fact that shortly after the failure of Bay of Pigs, I wrote a letter to JFK advising him to establish a naval blockade around Cuba. Now, I didn't know at the time if my letter had even been read by the president, but later on, in searching through the archives and the JFK library, I came across my original documents, and not only had they been read by the president, but he sent them on to the State Department with a few notations of his own. And, of course, the rest is history to some extent. But another thing that was very alarming during that period of time, I didn't find out until later on, but very little was actually credited to our intelligence community with respect to finding the missile bases and missiles about to be deployed on the island of Cuba. That was something that was accomplished by private citizens and the president rather than the professional intelligence community. And you begin to wonder, Dr. Stan, what is their purpose? What is really their agenda? Either they are incompetent, or they have some other priority or motive which is not in the benefit or for the benefit of the American people.
Well, I would agree with that. In fact, for the listeners out there, I'm old enough to remember Look magazine, it was either June or July of that year, and Senator Keating was quoted there, and they had, this was Look magazine, this was 1962, and there were the pictures of where they were going to put the missiles. You could see the silos. Everything was there on these pictures in Look magazine, but you see, what they wanted to do, and contrary to everything you've heard, they knew in June or July that the missiles were going in there. But what they wanted to do is wait until just before the election. Why? Well, because John Fitzgerald Kennedy was extremely unpopular with the American people. And, of course, 1962, the congressional elections, he would have lost control of the House of Representatives, and they wouldn't have been able to get their socialist programs in. And so, of course, they waited until mid-October, sort of like they're waiting right now. And then suddenly we've got this terrible crisis, and gee, we've got to stand behind our president. We're on the brink of a nuclear war. And yet they'd known at least for 4 months before that, 5 months before that, that those missiles were going in. So people have to understand that timing is everything. It's the way the stock market's going up right now.
Yes.
Why is it going up? Well, because the elections are coming up, and they don't want people to be unhappy with the elections coming. And of course, we may, right now with the war coming, why the American people are going to rally behind the president. After all, it's our duty to rally behind the president, even if there's no reason for going into the war. It's the patriotic thing to do. And it's amazing how many people can justify going to war because Saddam Hussein is a wicked man. Well, we've got all sorts of wicked men, and I would like to say maybe what we ought to do is go to war with the wicked men who kept Saddam Hussein in power in 1991, and of course in 1993 and 1995 when the Iraqi military wanted to overthrow him. In both instances, we betrayed them. And for the skeptic out there, the book is See No Evil by Robert Baer, who was the CIA agent in charge of northern Iraq, of the Kurdistan area, in 1995. And he tells you, in 93 and again in 95, the Iraq military tried to overthrow Saddam Hussein. In both instances, we betrayed them. And now we say, gee, really the Iraqi people ought to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And of course, the truth of the matter is, we have kept him in power until just this time. What is the real agenda behind what's going on? Not what we're told, but what's the real agenda? What do you think about it, John? Why are we going to war over there?
Well, I was going to give us some reasons why probably we should not be going to war over there, but I'll try to answer your question as best I can. First of all, one word seems to be creeping up from time to time, and that's oil and natural gas. It appears that there are some people in America and Europe who are very interested in developing Saddam Hussein's oil fields for their profit and benefit. And, of course, you have to get someone behind you, and what better organization could there be than the United States government in terms of making a profit? Because whoever is able to acquire those fields and control them would certainly make a tremendous profit, and they could sort of set their own price without having to deal with OPEC and some of the other surrounding OPEC nations in the Middle East. That's one possibility. Another factor that seemingly does not come to the surface is the fact that there is currently an agreement amongst the nations of Iraq, Iran, and Syria. A lot of this can be credited to the work and dedication of the Marxist-Leninist who was up until recently even premier of Russia, and that's Yevgeny Primakov. And Yevgeny Primakov spent most of his career in the Middle East for the Soviet Union, began with corresponding for TASC, and then, or TASS, I should say, and then he went on to, with that dual role, which would include espionage. He rose to the ranks of the KGB and then became Russia's foreign minister. But his main focus was on in the Middle East. And considering the fact that he was of Jewish ancestry, that was quite remarkable. And even today, if you go on to some of the websites, for example, Iran mentions a book that's recently been written about Primakov, and it's very complimentary. They mention him as being supposedly a great statesman, and you can begin to understand why when they bring out the fact, of course, that he has supplied Iran with a considerable amount of Russian materiel, such as tanks, missiles, possibly even nuclear weaponry. And he's also established very close ties with Iran, Iraq, and Syria.
Now, isn't that interesting? We finance Russia. We provide them with the technology, and then they provide it to Iran, which, of course, is deeply involved with the whole world terrorist movement aimed at America. So there's something wrong with this picture. In other words, maybe there's an X factor there that we're missing. Would you say that might be true?
Well, I think there are several X factors that are missing. First of all, the best analogy that I could give in terms of what type of war we might be facing in the Middle East with Iraq would be a Korean War, a war in which a client state such as the Soviet Union and possibly China might be supporting it clandestinely for quite some period of time, just as was true during the Korean War when North Korea was supported by both the former Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China. there is another reason why we should be very concerned about going into Iraq. As I mentioned earlier, it's a secular nation. Now, I personally don't like their dictator, Saddam Hussein, but he has curtailed the movement of the Islamic jihadists or Wahhabists from gaining control of that nation.
We're going to be back here in just a moment, John. Just hang on. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. And this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we hope that many of you will want to join the Radio Liberty family, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day and on the weekends as well. That's how we're able to be on almost 50 outlets across America every week. Maybe some of them are just half an hour a week, but at least people are hearing the truth they're never going to hear elsewhere. So if you'd like to become part of our team and help us do what we do, remember our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY.
An area in which heavy losses financially would occur for the oil companies, American oil companies such as Chevron, if indeed we were to go into Iraq. Now, we might be able to make some profit for those same oil companies by invading Iraq, but I don't know if that's going to offset the losses if Russia does not approve of our moving into that area of Iraq. And again, we need to understand that it will not just be an invasion of Iraq, because of the alliance that Primakov helped put together when he had a role in that region. So as strange as it seems, there's a very good possibility that Iran as well as Syria would come to Iraq's aid at this time. And I don't think we're quite prepared to take on three nations simultaneously that might be supplied almost indefinitely by the Soviet Union and China. And for some reason, I don't think we are considering all of these pieces very carefully. And as I alluded to earlier, our intelligence community has not been providing at least the government with the best of information for America's interests. Now, either they are incompetent or they are traitors. There's not much room in between.
Or maybe they have a different loyalty. Maybe this all has to do with an entirely different agenda that the American people are not allowed to know.
Well, I think it has something to do with the One World Order and with the UN. And I might also add perhaps the Gorbachev Foundation or Institute over in Moscow has some role in this as well. Now, I realize that most Americans believe that the Soviet Union is dead, but for some reason all of the former leaders of the Soviet Union seem to be very much alive and very active.
Isn't that amazing that the leader of every one of those independent states is now an ex-communist? You would think they would find somebody who had not been part of this evil empire to lead these countries. But of course, now that communism is dead, why, we can justify pouring more and more and more money in and more technology and of course, paying them to deactivate their bombs and their missiles as they build new and even better missiles than they had before. So there's something really very wrong. We pour money into Russia, and they're in full military production for war. We pull more money into China, they're in full military production for war. Strange things are going on in the world today.
Yes, and as you just pointed out, practically every current leader is a former Marxist-Leninist. And this is especially true in all of the Central Asian countries, such as Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan, where all of the oil and natural gas is located in the Aral-Caspian region. And this is one reason why I think if I were to write a letter to George W. Bush, again, I would certainly call this to his attention, as well as perhaps our loss of further cooperation with Russia regarding Afghanistan. because they very much are in favor of oil companies making large profits. And how is that proposed pipeline from Turkmenistan to Pakistan passing through western Afghanistan going to occur if indeed the Russians don't want to cooperate and play ball with us? So that's another bargaining chip that we need to bring to Bush's attention, if that's what it takes. Because there are very few gains to be determined from an all-out war with Iraq. We would probably be further ahead if we just had some very precise bombings of the palatial regions or the palaces in Iraq, rather than to make an all-out landing and invasion.
Well, you see, John, what the American people aren't allowed to know is that we have kept Saddam Hussein in power for many years. We backed him during the 1980s. We left him in power in 1991. We kept him in power in 93 and 95 when the Iraq military wanted to overthrow him. And now we're going to war with him. Why? I mean, it doesn't make sense. Why didn't we simply allow the Iraqis or support the Iraqi military when they wanted to overthrow him in 93 and again in 95? Is there another agenda behind this? And I suspect that there really is. And I suspect that the American people will never understand that there really is a secret group that runs the world. How do we know that? Well, we simply read their writings, and you can read their writings in a little pamphlet called The Spiritual Hierarchy, which they put out. It's put out by World Goodwill. You can actually read the writings from World Goodwill. Some of them are quoted in Tex Mar's wonderful book, The Circle of Intrigue, where the World Goodwill talks about the Illuminati and the Illuminated Ones. This is the people on the other side talking about it. This is not what you and I have to say. Yes, there is really a secret hierarchy that rules the world. And the fact that most people have never heard of it, reflects the degree of control that exists over what the American people think. But there are these organizations. They publish magazines and pamphlets, and we take their pamphlets, and we have their pamphlets, and we make the pamphlets available to you or give you the sources of reference where you can check them out. Any of you out there would like to get the pamphlet put out by the Lucis Trust and under the guise of the World Goodwill Movement, where they talk about the spiritual hierarchy that rules the world, and that all the governments of the world are ruled by a small group of enlightened ones? Why, give us a call. We'll send it to you free of charge at 1-800-544-8927. But behind all of the things that go on, behind the wars that are always created and fought by men who never understood what it's about. And an awful lot of men are going to die in this battle. An awful lot of Americans are going to die. An awful lot of Iraqi citizens, civilians are going to die. A lot of Iraqis will be forced to fight for a man that we have kept in power all this time. And, of course, the American people are responsible for what their government does. Because unlike other governments, supposedly, at least in theory, our government is responsible to us, and what goes around comes around. And if we, by our inaction, do nothing, and there is a great deal of death and destruction, who will be held responsible for that in eternity? Who will God hold responsible, and who will God punish? And I really think that the American people should very seriously contemplate the fact that men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a time of moral crisis such as we have today, try to maintain a position of neutrality. And, of course, to ignore evil is in itself evil.
Yes. I was also going to say, Dr. Stan, I know many people have said this before, that if indeed we were to make an invasion of Iraq, that we would be leaving Taiwan, an island nation, wide open for a similar blockade or invasion from mainland China. And although we've heard this several times, we don't really fully understand how significant Taiwan itself is as a nation. It has one of the most highly skilled labor forces of any nation in the world. A very high percentage of its people are very well educated. It has a very high gross national product for a nation of its size. It's comparable almost to South Korea and Japan in many ways. And yet, here we have this bastion of freedom in the Pacific, which our State Department does not officially even recognize as an official nation. And you begin to wonder if we would keep our promises, or even be able to keep our promises, if indeed we were to invade Iraq. Because it's my understanding that an invasion of Iraq will require practically all of our current naval fleet, and that's the only deterrent that we currently are able to provide to prevent Taiwan from being taken over by the mainland. But if this isn't quite sinking in, let me just say this. A good share of the satellite imagery instruments, a good share of our military equipment, a good share of the electronic equipment that we have within our households, many of these components are manufactured in Taiwan, and most Americans are unaware of this.
Well, I think that the average American, of course, has very little idea what's really going on in the world, that we have transferred a great deal of our technology and our industrial base to our potential enemy, which is Communist China. And Communist China has never veered from its ultimate goal of having hegemony in Asia. And, of course, Communist China is in the process of building intercontinental ballistic missiles to be used to threaten us, as is the Soviet Union. And we are actually providing both the technology and the funding so that they can build these weapons. And the question is, why would we do something that stupid unintentionally? And, of course, the president keeps saying, oh, we've got to have a missile defense, and we're going to build a missile defense. But the missile defense is specifically designed not to prevent either Chinese or Russian intercontinental ballistic missiles from hitting the United States. Now, why wouldn't you want to defend America? If you're loyal to this country, you would think that would be your first objective and goal, would be the survival of this country. But you see, it would appear that many of our leaders have a different allegiance, and that would be to the New World Order and the New World Religion. And unless there are terrible and horrible calamities here in the United States, the American people will never willingly go into this this new internationalist alliance that our leaders dream of.
This is so true, Dr. Stan. And I just want to remind everyone out there to pray and... One thing we forget about, most people nowadays, when you think of praise, maybe 10 seconds, 30 seconds a day, but, you know, the leaders of our nation would get down on their knees and they would pray at their meetings for hours at a time without hesitation. I'm talking about the President's Cabinet of Washington and his successors. I'm talking about Congress, that legislative body, the Supreme Court, when it met. It's hard to believe because 60 seconds seems to be quite an ordeal for our current legislators in Washington, but there was a time when this was a godly nation, and I think we have to return to it. There are many people throughout the world that are not looking to America as being a godly nation, but rather a very cocky, arrogant, materialistic nation with no compassion whatsoever. Certainly, the people in Bali who are Buddhists have compassion, and they're not seeing this in Americans like they once did. So I think we as Christians need to get down on our knees and pray to the Almighty continuously about this situation. And I would also encourage to write letters to the president while there is still time. We don't know how much longer we will have this privilege of being able to write to our president and members of Congress. So I would urge everyone out there to try to put together a convincing letter. Be courteous, be accurate, think in terms of an oil man's perspective, and perhaps we can make a difference. But the most important thing and the bottom line is we must pray. And I don't think there's ever been a time in our past that we need to pray as much as we do now, because our nation could be lost within a matter of years. Perhaps
I think you are you are very, very optimistic.
I may be. It could be.
I think it could be much, much sooner than that. In fact, all we have to do is turn on television watch our movies and see the depravity that are manifest there. And, of course, you go into the Islamic nations, they point to our television and they say, this is what America is. The naked women, the explicitly sexual scenes. These are offensive to any intelligent people throughout the world, any people who have any religious beliefs. And I'm not talking about Christians. I'm talking about Muslims or Hindus or Buddhists or anybody. They're all offended by America, the greatest exporter of pornography in the world, is doing today to corrupt the rest of the world. And I don't think God's going to be mocked. I believe he is going to take action against this country, and I believe, of course, we have the political, we have the ideological, we have the financial, but we have the spiritual, and that's what everybody's missing. Because, of course, our ministers don't even want to tell us that God is a God of judgment that is never mentioned today. But he is. He's a God of judgment and justice, and he is a God of vengeance. Certainly, he doesn't want that anybody should perish. Everybody has the choice, and they can make that choice. But just as he judges people in the afterlife, he judges nations in this life. And I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, and his justice cannot sleep forever.
I concur with you, Dr. Stan. There has to be a spiritual awakening in America. For those of you who don't know too much about my background, it goes back, in terms of my ancestry, to the early years of America. I know most people seem to think that our government is based supposedly on British or English common law, but in reality it was based on research done on ancient Jewish law, and that became the basis of our original government. And
okay, well, we're out of time, John, and we'll get you on again here real soon. But thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Oh, the Lord bless you, Doctor.
And you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And, of course, the laws of America came from the Bible. And, of course, the laws of the Bible did come from the Old Testament. And, of course, Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England was based entirely on the Bible, and that was the basis of our law, at least at one time. Now, of course, it's on the whims of the members of the Supreme Court, many of whom hate Christianity, and that's why they've been appointed by both the Democrats and the Republicans. Remember, 7 of our present Supreme Court justices were appointed by Republican presidents. So until tomorrow at the same time, pray for America, pray for revival, pray for God's mercy on this nation. And so please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And we'll be back again tomorrow at the same time. Until then, may the Lord be with you. Yeah.